So welcome to the second Mattingly Lecture of 2012. I'm Rebecca Lingwood, the Director of the Institute of Continuing Education here at Mattingly Hall. And first I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce our chair for this evening, Dr. Kate Pretty, so that she may introduce our speaker, Anne Cotton, and chair the questions at the end of the lecture. Dr. Kate Pretty is an archaeologist and has been principal of Homerton College, Cambridge, since 1991. And after much hard work on Kate's part, Homerton received its Royal Charter in 2010. Dr. Pretty has been chairman of the Faculty Board of Archaeology and Anthropology and the Council of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, and also a member of General Board. She became a Fellow of the Society of Antiquaries in 2000, and since 2008 has been President of the Council for British Archaeology. Between 2004 and 2010, Kate was one of the university's five pro-vice chancellors when she had special responsibilities for outreach, lifelong learning and international strategy, as well as overseeing the work of the university's museums and libraries. And it was during this time that Kate got to know us here particularly well as chairman of the Institute's management board. Since 2010, Kate has been a deputy vice-chancellor of the university. So before I hand over to Kate, could I just remind you that if you've brought your mobile phones with you, now's the time to switch them off. Thank you very much. Thank you, Kate.
This is the beginning of International Women's Week. I'm not sure whether our speaker was chosen with that in mind, but of course it's a particularly apposite way to start the week. It's a great pleasure for me to be back here. I have given innumerable awards in this room to hundreds of students of the University of Cambridge working part-time, but I don't normally have to speak from a podium. About 15 years ago, my late husband, Tjeerd van Aandel, found himself at the Waldorf Astoria in company with Octavio Paz, Helmut Schmidt, and a couple of fellow Americans, being recorded in discussion by the Japanese newspaper, the Asahi Shimbun. They were doing a project about the world of the future and intended to take the discussion into schools. Tjeerd's role was to talk about climate change, but when he got back from New York, all he wanted to talk about at length was the wisdom of Helmut Schmidt and his passion for the education of women and its transforming effect on economics, on health, on population dynamics, and on well-being, as we would call it nowadays, in the developing world. Schmidt was mostly thinking then of South America. But at the same time that Schmidt was thinking about South America, our speaker tonight, Dr. Anne Cotton, had already realised the importance of women's education in rural Africa. I've known about CAMFED really not quite from its inception, but for a very long time. And that interest in the work of women's education in the developing world is absolutely ingrained into me. It's, of course, in some ways, one of the most sustainable ways of creating change. Since I've been a subscriber for well over a decade, so is my college. And we have to admit to you that my introducer, Rebecca, and my successor, Anne, are all fellows of the same college. So you're in a very family circumstance this evening. This lecture will explore the history of girls' education in Africa over the last 20 years and describe the current status quo in the five countries in which CAMFED is working. And Anne is going to describe the CAMFED model that supports girls through primary and secondary education and on to securing livelihoods in the rural areas of Africa. She is the architect, the founder, the executive director of CAMFED International, which is very widely recognised and respected as an example of best practice in girls' education. And it's at the local and national levels where CAMFED's influence is most strongly felt and where it exercises a leadership role, advising national governments and international organisations and multi-stakeholder coalitions. Its advocacy of girls' education and child protection is ensuring that the voices of rural girls and women are heard at the highest level. And one of the most notable things for me is the fact that it is indeed the voices of the girls that have been educated through CAMFED, which are now heard. This is not a process of, as it were, late colonialism. This is something which actually empowers the women of these five countries to get stuck into making serious change in the nature of both the economics and of the education of the countries going forward. Since CAMFED's inception in 1993, about 1 million children, primarily girls, have benefited from its education programme across a network of just under 3,000 schools. But more important in some ways for me is that on leaving school, over 5,000 young women have received business training and start-up grants to establish their own rural enterprises. This is sustainability on a very grand scale. And when I was involved in helping fundraising from the international corporates like Goldman Sachs, it is this view that takes you from the school and into the post-school stage, which is one of the major successes, I think, of CAMFED, because this is building on one form of investment. Anne has touched over 1 million schoolgirls, and through them, though, many, many more people, their siblings, their parents, their grandparents, and as they grow up and become parents themselves, I think you're a bit young to have any grandchildren, but maybe just about getting there, many, many more people have benefited from this. There aren't many people today who can say that they have influenced the lives of multi-million numbers of people in five countries. Anne has won numerous awards for her work, including an honorary doctorate in law from Cambridge, a piece of enlightenment for which I think the university should be praised. She has an OBE, not nearly high enough, from the Queen, and the Skoll and Schwab Awards for social entrepreneurship. I have worked with her over some time. It is an invigorating, exhausting, highly educative, and thought-provoking activity. It is my enormous pleasure to introduce my colleague, Dr. Anne Cotton, tonight. We are richer in Cambridge for having her with us.
Thank you, Kate, for that very generous introduction. And thank you for the invitation to speak here. This evening, it's my very great pleasure to speak about the subject that indeed has been my passion for the last 20 years. And I came to this subject almost by chance because I was actually preparing for a longer study and went out to Zimbabwe to do some field work. And I went out to a district called Nyami Nyami, which is on the shores of Lake Kariba. And it's the district where the Tonga people were shifted at the building of the Kariba Dam in 1956. 80,000 people were in the wrong place for them at that time, and they were forcibly shifted onto land that was unoccupied because it really wasn't land that was deemed to be able to support human life in any status that would provide well-being and security. And I went... it was my first trip to Africa, and I had read everything I thought there was to read on the issue of girls' education. And the conclusion at that time, the received wisdom at that time, was that girls were not at school because of the resistance of families to education. Now, that certainly remains the case in some parts of the world. But in that district at that time, I heard from everybody that I spoke to, teachers, parents, local chiefs, and children themselves, that girls weren't at school because of family poverty. And of course, that family poverty was gendered family poverty. There were gendered aspects to it. And the reality was that boys were in a much better position to have work when they left school and to actually reinvest in the family, to create some security for the family with no other safety net, no safety net of social welfare or pension schemes or unemployment benefit. The security is the family. And so boys were the ones who went to school. And in the district where I was, there were seven boys for every girl at secondary school. And of course, that was sustaining a vicious cycle of poverty. So on the basis of what I'd heard, I began to re-examine my objectives, re-examine what I'd thought I would continue with, which was a study, and re-examine the ethics of that from my personal standpoint. And I came home and said to my unsuspecting husband, who's in the audience tonight, "We have to do something." And he said, "What do you suggest?" And I said, "I've no idea." But I knew that I couldn't walk away from what I'd learned. I remember opening the fridge door and bursting into tears because I had just come from a community where there was no food security. Children with distended stomachs, mothers who died on the way to the clinics, young girls, adolescent girls who died on their way to hospital with complications in pregnancy. And I came back to Cambridge and to my secure life with these memories. And so I did complete my study. And I promised the chief Moller, that I would come back. And indeed, 6 months later, I did. And he was surprised to see me. Of course, communications then, this was 20 years ago, wasn't what it is today. Even in those areas, there are mobile phones. And he said he was surprised to see me and welcomed me back. And I said, "You said that we could work together for girls' education, and I'm back. Let's figure out what we can do together." And, you know, when I had come back to this country and I went to see various agencies to talk about the idea that I had, I was met with unalloyed scepticism. And that was entirely justified. I can look back and know that I was an absolute novice. But I think, you know, the fact that I met with scepticism and the fact that I was such a novice has actually been one of the important foundations of Camford's success. Because I had to go and I had to learn from the people who were in the best position to teach me. And that was the community. And that has been Camford's learning ground ever since the beginning. The communities, the girls with whom we work, as Kate said, girls are indeed the voice of this organization. And from the outset, it was to grow with full community support, with full community advice, with partnership at all levels. And that is the basis of Camford's work. And that is the basis of our success. And so at that time, we began. And Chief Moller, he called a meeting. Now, no conventional communications as we knew it at the time. As I said, no telephones, no landlines, but an incredible system of communications through the headmen. So the chief sent out a message through his headmen that went through to every household. And within 24 hours, I was sitting in a meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning outside the local secondary school, and there were hundreds of people. And if I had been in any doubt that there was support for girls' education in that district, here was the answer. Because that's what they had come to discuss. And we sat through the entire day. I had an interpreter telling me the discussion that was going on. And then that day, we fashioned what is in effect the Camford model. Because the community said, well, we can't come together, hundreds of us like this, every time there's a decision to be made. How do we create a decision-making institution at the community level? And so they decided that a committee was needed. And they decided that the people who needed to sit on that committee were all those constituencies with the power to influence children's lives. Mothers, fathers, school heads, the local social welfare, the local police, the traditional leader, all those who were present in that community. And they came together as a committee that were responsible to the community as a whole, responsible to report back to the constituencies they represented, certainly responsible to Camford, as it now had become, for decisions, but first and foremost, to be responsible to the girls. And that is the principle of Camford's. That is the governing principle of Camford, that it is fundamentally responsible and accountable to the client, whether the girl, whether the boy, whether the young woman, whether the community. And I know Peter Sherritt is one of our board members. In fact, he's the chair of Camford's board. He's in the audience here tonight. So from Peter to our boards in Africa, to every member of staff, to the committees we work with, everyone is fundamentally responsible to the client. And so, over the years, the context in which we work, the context of girls' education has shifted. In those days, 20 years ago, there was incredible scepticism around who was responsible, and the received wisdom was indeed that it was parents. And I came to the conclusion that it was the culture of poverty, not the poverty of culture, that was preventing girls from going to school. And the sceptic said, well, after 6 months, you'll find they'll drop out. Not so. We have achieved consistently over 90% retention in our programmes over the entire period in 5 countries. Parents want the education of all their children. But when the economic and social factors favour one group or another, then they will, understandably, common sense will tell them to invest in one group or another. And that has remained the case, that the socio-economic circumstances around education still favour the education of sons. But the international community has shifted. At that time, really the argument was around rights, the right of every child to education. That had been established. But rights wasn't enough to get every child into school. Wasn't enough to get the kind of funding, to get the political leverage, to get the consistency around the policymakers for this issue. What changed was the realization that Kate has referred to of the impact of girls' education. There were some key moments. The World Bank certainly got it in the early 90s. And increasingly, there were papers that were advocating for girls' education. It had become more instrumentalist, if you like, as an issue. It was realised that there was an incredible relationship between the education of girls and child mortality or child survival, that there was a relationship between maternal mortality and girls' education. There was a relationship between the socio-economic life of the country as a whole when educated women were coming into the workforce. There was an issue, the issue of domestic violence and the fact that educated women were far less likely to be victims and to actually create homes where there was more harmony and a better environment for children. And the population issue. The recognition that as increasingly the environmental issue was coming onto the agenda, that girls' education gave the promise of lowering population growth because educated women tend to make the decision to limit their families. They have choices. There are certain countries of the world, just a few in the Middle East, where this isn't the case, where wealthy women are having more children than their poorer counterparts. But for the most part across the world, the better educated women have less children because they take control. And it isn't about telling women how many children they can have. It is about the fact that they have internalized a sense of their own power in relation to the family, in relation to the wider community, and they will take decisions that they will act upon. So the resources in the family aren't stretched across more and more children. So it moved from the justice of girls' education to the imperative of girls' education. And Camford certainly works in both. So the question was then not the argument as to why girls' education was important, but to the what should be provided, and crucially for Camford, the how. And I think this is where we have added great value to the sector. The work that we do in 5 countries, in Zimbabwe, Zambia, Ghana, Tanzania, and Malawi, is certainly having a great influence in those countries, and we are working at policy level. The Zambia government, for example, has adopted Camford's child protection policy into all its schools, and we are working with the Ministry of Education to train across the country. Barbara Chilangwa is our director in Zambia and former permanent secretary. And the learning that we are taking from those five countries is influencing the wider sector of girls' education. So we are getting into a strong advisory position. Because our results are strong. Our retention rates are strong. The impact that we are having on enrollment rates, not only in relation to the girls that we directly support, but into the whole school environment, are demonstrating the impact that we are having. So increasingly, organisations, development agencies and ministries are coming to us to look at the how we deliver girls' education. I just want to look at some of the issues tonight that I think actually frames our work. Transparency and accountability at all levels. Now, that can, of course, be seen as something idealistic. As I mentioned earlier, CAMFED's accountability to the client is fundamental, is a fundamental imperative of our work. And so for us, the way we work, the way we work with all partners, and the way we build a sense of accountability to the child is what marks us out. Now, when you think about a child in a rural part of Africa, many are in homes where bereavement is common. Many are in homes where there is long-term ill health. Children have huge anxieties as they're growing up. And many are living with grandparents who themselves have often lost their entire group of children and have now taken on responsibility for the care of the next generation. So it is incumbent on us as an organisation to tell people what they are entitled to. Now, this may seem very obvious, but it isn't something that is actually part of the culture of all international development agencies. If we're working to raise money for children, as we are, then those children should know what they're entitled to. Their parents, their grandparents, their guardians, their teachers should know what they're entitled to. So the transparency and accountability is part and parcel of the way we work. So every child knows that they're entitled. For example, if they're in the bursary program at secondary school level, they're entitled to two school uniforms. They're entitled to school shoes. They're entitled to sportswear and stationery and books. And if they're in boarding school, they're entitled to a mattress. And they're entitled to sheets and towels and soaps. And they're entitled to pocket money, because the girls we support have nothing to bring to school, nothing at home. Some live in such basic conditions that there is literally nothing in the homes other than a few plates, a few twigs often I've seen in the corner for firewood, and they sleep on the bare floor. This is poverty at the deepest level. And they are not used to asking. They are certainly not used to demanding. But we encourage that. We say, these are your entitlements. And if you do not receive what you're entitled to, then this is where you come. So for us, for a grandmother, to have the confidence to come into a school when she herself has probably never attended school in her life, and to ask to see the head teacher and to say, my granddaughter's school uniform, it hasn't arrived yet. That's change, because we're changing the balance in the relationship. We're changing the balance of power between that grandmother and the head teacher, between that grandmother and CAMFED. So this is absolutely fundamental to the transparency and accountability. It's the service that we provide. We are in service to the children, and we are not looking for gratitude, because this is about entitlement. They are not grateful beneficiaries. They are clients, and there is a very clear distinction. So all these various groups that you see here, we are building accountability and transparency at all those levels. You can see mother support groups in the community, school management committees, community development committees, ministries of education, just some of the many institutions that we work with. Now, the community development committee is that institution that I told you about that was first formed in Mola We have those committees across the programme in every country. They are common to every aspect of our work. And we have an incredible number of activists. You know, volunteers, activists, will only continue to work with you if they feel valued, if they feel respected. There is ownership at a very high level of the CAMFED programme in the communities, and that is what sustains and grows the activism and the volunteerism. We take a long-term approach. International development tends to be very fragmented. People say, well, are you working on quality or are you working on access? Are you working at primary level? Are you working at secondary level? Are you working at tertiary level? Are you working on microfinance? It is a very fragmented industry. But the reality of poverty is such that you cannot create transformative and sustainable change by looking through a very narrow lens at a community. You might well support a child through primary education, but then what? They don't have the means to make that transition into secondary education without support from outside, because the financing just isn't there. The availability of places to go to seek help, they're not there. And then what? When a young woman comes out of school in a rural area, because we work exclusively in the rural areas where the poverty tends to be greatest and where there are least opportunities. And so when a young girl graduates from secondary school, there are opportunities for her at that level. And I will show you a short film clip soon that describes some of the opportunities available. But what that means is that there's a greater likelihood that that young woman will remain in the community, will reinvest the benefits of her education in her community. Now, we started back 20 years ago with 32 girls, when it was friends and family. One of those 32 girls is a woman called Angeline. Angeline, now Murimiwa, is her married name. She was then Angeline Mukwendere. She's now the executive director for Zimbabwe. So we now have those early clients of CAMFED's actually leading programs, working very closely with the Ministry of Education, the civil service in Zimbabwe. Complex context, as you can imagine, that she has to negotiate. And we have still have secured, largely as a result of her leadership, a multi-million pound investment into Zimbabwe. So there you have it. Coming full circle, a holistic and long-term approach, and you see it in Angeline's life, but also in the lives of many others, because we take that long-term point of view. And we measure. Measurement is not an option. As part of our accountability and transparent process, that too is an imperative, because we are accountable to our clients. So we are tracking 64 indicators, which tell us how we are doing, tell us the quality of the service we are providing, tell us such things as how many activists that we have and their level of engagement, tell us how we are affecting the enrollment of the broader school environment, tell us about the gender balance within the school between boys and girls, tell us about the changing examination results for all children within the school system. So we are tracking examination results across all our programs, and then we're tracking what people are going on to do after education. It is a very holistic tracking program that we have, and we are supporting ministries of education to do this. You know, ministries of education in Africa and the countries in which we work are incredibly understaffed, under-resourced. If, for example, an education officer wants to visit a school which is 120 miles from his base or her base, doesn't have petrol to put in that vehicle. Vehicle sits outside. So with us, they can track. We are helping and working with them to do their job. It is a program that works absolutely hand in glove and in a complementary way with existing systems. It doesn't set up parallel systems. So what we see, these results are from Zambia. Between 2003 and 2010, we saw a 17% increase in female enrollment in CAMFED partner schools. We saw an 85% increase pass rate for girls taking maths and science, and this is a critical step for them to get into the next level of education. As we know, technology, maths and science are the subjects now that are getting people into jobs that are well remunerated. A 90% retention rate of bursary-supported girls across all countries. Our most challenging environment at the moment, in fact, is Malawi. Well, you have probably read about the circumstances, the difficult political environment of Malawi at the moment, where human rights are really being violated. We even saw recently tear gas used against primary school children who, in fact, were protesting against the fact that their teachers were not coming to school. The teachers weren't at school because they hadn't been paid for 3 months. So we are certainly seeing deteriorating situation in Malawi. Those particular events took place in town, but in the rural areas we haven't seen that level of difficulty. But what we are seeing is a deteriorating economic environment in which children are becoming more and more vulnerable. And so how do you create something that is sustainable in such a context? Well, the critical mass that we note there, that is in fact the bursary program, the secondary school bursary program, which is the most expensive part of CAMFED's work in many ways because it is so holistic. The support we provide to girls is so complete. And that's partly because that recognizing their vulnerability and the fact that if we do not provide a full package, there is nowhere they can go for extra support. So, for example, if you don't provide examination fees to do the public exams, then where are girls going to go? And one thing that we do know is that the only sometimes recourse option they have is to have a sexual relationship, a temporary sexual relationship with someone for which they're paid, of course, completely undermining their health, their well-being. But this is partly a reflection of the desire that they have for education, which is so very intense. So that critical mass of girls then is a crucial building block for sustainability. And then the social financial support that is broader for the broader group over half a million. And then the local philanthropy that these combined generate. What I mean by that is that communities themselves are taking action as a result of the catalytic impact of CAMFED. Just a couple of weeks ago, a district called Wedza, which is due south of Harare, about 2 hours' drive, decided that they were going to launch their own bursary scheme. The community came together and said, we are going to extend further the number of girls going to school. So this is what we are tracking. We do not claim this. What we do is track it to see what the catalytic impact of our work is. And Kate referred to some numbers. Actually, these for 2011, our numbers are audited and they're just literally off the press. And so the total school population benefiting from an improved learning environment, so for example, where we invest in quality of learning, we are providing training for teachers, we're providing educational resources, that number is now 1,940,700. That's the cumulative total. Then the total number that of girls who have received bursary support, you see there, 60,467. Then the social and financial support, the 502,000, that's the safety net fund, because you know head teachers face on a day-by-day basis an incredible crisis of children coming to see them and saying, I can't keep coming to school. My grandmother says that she doesn't have enough money to buy me a new pair of trousers, and my trousers are falling down, and literally I've seen children running around the playground holding their trousers up. So for boys and girls, we provide those basic basic needs what will keep them in the school system. If a child hasn't appeared for a week in school, there's a teacher mentor who will go and find out where the child is, how they are, and if they're sick or if there's someone sick at home, they will intervene and support them. And so through that method, we are enabling more and more children to stay in the school system. The head teachers feel that they have an ally in us where they can come. So many teachers and head teachers are actually paying out of their own really fairly meagre incomes to support the education of children. They say, how can we sit in classrooms where children are fainting from hunger? Of course we are providing food for the children in our school. And this is coming out of teachers' incomes. So we work to really extend what they can do. So these are some of the numbers and the growth of numbers. And they're very precise. We publish our numbers, and as I say, we do very strong internal audits because every child counts, every child matters, every client an individual, so a unit of one, and we need to know where they are, what they're doing, how they are, and we need to intervene when they need extra support. Now, let me just look at my watch because there's no, and I know I can talk for hours about this subject. So what I want to do is share with you a short film clip, which is about a program that we have done in partnership with the University of Cambridge. So I thought it would be particularly interesting to share. Now, Goldman Sachs came to us about 4 years ago to talk about our post-secondary education program. They actually had heard about us through the Financial Times because we had been selected 2 years running for an appeal of the Financial Times, which is the most extraordinary appeal one can have because that newspaper, of course, goes into onto the desk of every CEO in the world, and it did generate a huge amount of interest in us. And they started having talks with us, and then they decided to invest in a program which is beyond the kinds of support we give, which really enables a young woman to move beyond secondary education and create some security for herself, what one might consider a subsistence business or a necessity business, and to move into something more like an opportunity business. Now, as we know, we're in a city which is just booming from the entrepreneurial sector, the entrepreneurship and the linkages with the university. What we were looking at was how can we start to generate wealth? How can we enable young women to be the agents of change? Not only to have some security themselves through subsistence businesses, but actually to create employment, to create new ideas, new businesses that they weren't seeing around them. Now, when you are living in a context of poverty, you tend to have a very risk-averse approach to life. If you can see that there are 20 hairdressers in your neighborhood, and they're all surviving, albeit not huge profits, but they are sustained, and you've got lots of little cafes and you've got lots of bicycle repair shops, then it's very clear to you that this is an opportunity. And so what you have is this constant proliferation of businesses competing with each other. We wanted to get beyond that, and we wanted to create new business ideas. But we wanted to help young women to get beyond that insecurity, to get beyond that risk aversion, because the aversion comes from the very fact that they are so important in the family. Their success is really going to have an impact on everyone around them. So it is an imperative for them that they should succeed. So what we did in Zambia is we worked with the International Labour Organization and the Ministry of Education, and with the Judge Business School and Cambridge Assessment, we actually designed a course for young women coming out of school. And across the country, we recruited young women from Camford's bursary program who were showing leadership at their schools and who were showing a desire to actually establish businesses. And the program was actually carried out in a place called Lake Bangwa-Ulu. Anne Lonsdale, many of you will know, she came out to Lake Bangwa-Ulu. And rather than actually spend the money in the town and bring the young women into the town, we actually recreated the circumstances for an entrepreneurship program, actually in very challenging circumstances on the shores of a lake. And I remember days when we had 70 chickens arriving, not 70 chickens arriving ready to go in the pot, but of course 70 live chickens arriving and plucking chickens, and all that became part and parcel of what needed to happen on a regular basis. The tonnage of rice and potatoes that seemed to be cooked on very basic, with very basic methods. And we created a learning environment in the context in which the problems lie. So we invited social entrepreneurs from around the world, particularly through the Skoll network of social entrepreneurs. You know, Jeff Skoll, one of the co-founders of eBay, has an organization of 70 entrepreneurs. And they came in and they created the learning environment in which they said, let's look at the fish stocks of the lake. Let's look at the health needs of this community. So they created the circumstances for the learning actually on the shores. And this was the result. Well, this is some of the results that you will see.
When my dad passed away, it was very difficult for us to find books, pens, even the money to pay for our school fees.
Before Mom died, she took my real father to victim support. But he didn't respond still. I don't know why he just doesn't care for me.
Ngawafika fita kuri kukata kuma boxi, vale kanya. Nishi imobala mebo kwa mboko mbenchito. Vala mkulanda uka, shani na shani. So, wali uwafio ukalamba sana.
The women on our program, the 150 of them, come from very difficult backgrounds. Most of them, I can say almost 80% of these girls will have lost either one parent or both parents.
Eba ishile njeba ati pusha sufule washala waisa songa kuli ikosi. Iya kubati iba misambili shako ifya social entrepreneurship. Nalifilo kusumina na ishi ambafi okulila. Pantu unshale chitekila susina kwa tapwe shukuli ya msango.
This now marks the beginning of this very precious course to all of us, because it is the first of its kind in Zambia.
Is that right? The four of you have never used a computer before?
Yes.
How can someone get a sugar from the computer?
Yeah. How are we going to get the overall risk? By multiplying the likelihood of the event.
We're all business ladies here, isn't it? We've learned about marketing, we've learned about record keeping and everything.
As a social entrepreneur, this is what I think I can go and do in my community. This is how I think I can go and make an impact.
I feel it is very important for the young women to understand social entrepreneurship and to understand business entrepreneurship, because the young women and the communities from where they come from, they're the best persons to deal about the challenges that they're facing every day. For a long time, communities have not been able to deal with their own challenges because there is no, you know, these energetic young people to lead that process.
The current situation in Pika is very worrying in the sense that there's an increase in child abuse, child labor, and street children. Our mission statement will be to provide vulnerable children aged 2 to 6 years with basic education and good nutrition.
Our social enterprise is opening up a preschool for vulnerable children. And our objectives are to teach 30 to 60 children.
What's the preschool?
The preschool is the place where children are taken to be taught how to read, how to write, how to count numbers.
The children that we've enrolled here mainly are from vulnerable backgrounds, backgrounds where we find that their parents are dead, we find that they don't have all that much to sustain themselves. That's why if this preschool didn't exist, these children would just be roaming around.
There are 11 members in the group.
I'm the marketing director.
She's the marketing director, and I'm the school secretary.
And there are also subject coordinators who are in charge of certain subjects.
Like mathematics, there's Joyce. English, there's Cecilia, she's the coordinator. Child rights and responsibilities, there's JT. I didn't know I could run a preschool helping vulnerable children, and maybe in future I could do more than what I'm doing to develop my country and maybe develop my community. If I'm somebody, because I'm doing Varanda too, I'm going to do something to perform in the future. You can do something at least in future. To a Zambia, and I know you can be somebody one day.
So that gives you a flavor of the context, and the, you know, you can feel the energy, the incredible enthusiasm. You know, about 60% of the girls we support in secondary education are their parents have died from AIDS, so they're orphans. So they're coming from the most vulnerable families. And I think the social and emotional intelligence that we work with as an organization in terms of putting them at the center of concern actually then is reflected back in their communities, so that the way that they are working with children, and if you saw Mpika, you saw Bangwe Ulu and Samfia, these districts, then the level of vulnerability of children is so very acute. So it's very hard to overestimate the impact that that preschool is having on children's lives. And of course, when they see a child who's facing difficulties, they can intervene. So we measured that program, which was funded by Goldman Sachs, 434 young women went through that program, and now we're using it as a basis for scaling it up across the five countries. And we found that 70 new enterprises were launched, and 40 more businesses were then supported for growth. So as the 3 years went on. After 9 months, revenues were up 72% for entrepreneurs, and 64% of the school leavers were earning a salary and contributing to household expenditure. There was increased leadership and decision-making. Committee membership doubled to 98%. That meant that, you know, they're invited to be participating now on local committees. The visibility and status of young women is going up. Increased use of technology. You saw there the technology. Well, Aptivate, that was another Cambridge organisation that came in to establish the technology. And the centre that we've established in Samfia, which is now run by young women, has been replicated. $2 million was provided to us by Google to establish three networks across northern Ghana to replicate that. There was an increase in philanthropy and 18% increase in the number of participants supporting needy children outside the family. I could go on, but you know, we were really measuring the impact of this program and what it was doing on the lives of the young women, and then in terms of the support that they were generating. So CAMFID has come a long way from very, very small beginnings. I know we're in a city where a lot of the technology seemed to be started in sheds and garages, less in kitchens. And I think this has been a kitchen table organisation. And my son Gareth is here tonight with his fiancée Catherine, and I can well remember him coming home from school when he was in primary school and looking at a table of cakes because we had a stall on Cambridge Market and we used to sell cakes there on a Thursday, me and my long-suffering friends on February days. And his friend looked at these cakes, sort of, you know, eyes widened, and Gary said, no, you can't have those, they're for Africa. So this was how it started, and this is how it's grown, with that same spirit of entrepreneurship and that same can-do spirit, and that is what we are seeing now in so many of the girls and young women that we support. There is real transformation taking place, and it's very exciting to work with. It's something that we all feel incredibly passionate about, and many of you here tonight have supported us along the way, and I thank you very much for that. And now I'm just going to ask Kate to come back, because I think we're going to have time, if you'd like, to ask a few questions. Thank you. Indeed. Shall I come down? We'll stay here. Right.
There is time for some questions.
Yes. Supposing you were sat in a room with the presidents and prime ministers of USA, UK, France, Germany, and places like that, and they said, what can our governments do that would most help your work? How would you reply?
This is Cambridge, so we're going to have tough questions tonight, right?
Yes.
Well, indeed, we are getting into that position where we are sitting, in fact, sometimes at those tables. And certainly an increase in investment has to come. I mean, you know, the global community really has to recognize that we are all interconnected. And if we see poverty sustained in one part of the world, it will actually affect us all. And so there is a strong vested interest in support beyond the justice argument. So certainly the investment has to grow. And we are certainly, at this point in time in this country, we are increasing the investment in girls' education through DFID. They have made substantial commitments, new commitments to girls' education, recognising its importance. Other countries pulling back. I've just come back from Canada and talks with the Canadian aid agency, and there they are massively cutting their aid budget. So there are different approaches being taken across the world, but I think really the argument has been made in terms of just the impact that this the girls' education can have across the board. It's there, it's enshrined in the MDGs, but we just have to keep up that pressure because we are now, of course, facing economic crises in so much of the world, and so the investment in those parts of the world that need this support is diminishing. But I would also say that there has to be, alongside that investment, a recognition of the how this is undertaken. Because if it is not undertaken in full partnership with ministries of education, with full transparency and full partnership with communities, then it will be something that doesn't have sustainability. So it is an increasing investment, but also recognition of the how that around girls' education. Thank you.
Thank you.
So just returning back to the how do you imagine that CAMFED will evolve over the next 5 or so years to scale up and meet these demands?
Thank you. Well, we are certainly planning to grow into new countries. We will grow into new countries in Africa. We are also partnering with organisations now in beyond the continent of Africa. So we have started to recognise that when you have a values-based approach, that you can find common cause with organisations working with that same values-based approach, albeit on another issue. So we have established a partnership with IDEI India, which actually works on food security and irrigation, and with Gram Vikas in India, which works on sanitation and health, so that we can support their advances and progress around girls' education, and they can support ours, because while we're taking a holistic approach, we're not, of course, covering everything, and we can speed up the process of change. We're also increasing our investment into CAMA, because the organization of young women leaders now has been institutionalized, and it's operating at the Pan-African level. It has an international influence. The young women are getting onto international platforms, and by 2015, we are set to have 40,000 members of the CAMA organization. So here, an incredible network of change agents in the rural areas of Africa. We're also increasingly sharing the aspects of our work that can be replicated. We did a study, a governance study, with Linklaters, the global law firm, and that involved 4,000 pro bono hours that they gave us, travelled with us to Africa to really look at the model and see the how, and to develop a report with us. So we are looking to influence the wider sector. So that report has been shared very widely, and also they've now decided to fund a conference series, which actually kicks off at the University of Oxford in June this year. So we are also, you know, looking at where we can affect policy, where we can affect change. So it's the growth of our own programme, the expansion of the CAMA network, and seeing how we can support other organisations to really embed the kind of success that we're having in their own work. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Susan from Kenya, and I understand the poverty context that you've shared, and I really appreciate your holistic support. I have two questions. How do you select the needy cases, your needy clients? And is there pressure from the community to take up more? And how do you deal with such situations? And also, can you tell us more about the boys that you support? Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Let me start with the last part of the question first. And boys. Now, for Camford, it takes a very integrated approach, that change will not come through one group in society, but we recognise that girls are facing the greatest challenges. But at primary school, we support the education of boys as well as girls. It's in the transition to secondary education that girls face the biggest hurdles, and that's where we're investing in girls. We do support as well boys with disability at secondary school level, right through to tertiary level education as well. But for us, it's about working with the communities to say the education of every child matters. We are not exclusively a women's organisation working on the issue of girls' exclusion from education. We are very inclusive. And by that, we are inclusive in the partners that we have at the community level. You know, there are men and women working together for change. And we're also investing in the whole school environment on issues like child protection, issues on the improvement and the quality environment. Now, in relation to the selection process is held and owned at the community level. It is a transparent process, as I mentioned, in which the community can challenge as a whole. Now, it is important that we keep the balance right, that there isn't a single member of that committee who can actually wield power over members. And so that's one of the reasons that there is such a broad constituency on the panel itself, on the committee itself. And the criteria for selection is need. It is not academic performance. In some countries, not all, but the academic results will actually determine who moves on. But need is the criteria. And so it's really looking at the children in the community that cannot move on, particularly to secondary level education. At primary level, it's very holistic. We will support, you know, all those children with the need, because the costs are very, very low. It's at the bursary level that there is that criteria comes into play. And I was in Cheruponi district in Ghana before Christmas, and I was with the chair of our the committee there, and he's a local imam. And he was saying, you know, I met a lady and she said to me, I don't know why my daughter isn't supported into the program. And he said, well, perhaps you'd like to come and discuss it with me. So he came. She came along, and he opened the books for her, and he said, you know, these are the background, the children, you know the circumstances of children in this community. Tell me about your daughter. Where is she? Oh, she's at school. Well, who is paying for her education? Her uncle. He said, well, there you have it. She has support, albeit, you know, in the extended family. The children that we're supporting have no one. So that process of transparency is one that's very critical. We, of course, have staff. We have a policy of only recruiting Africans, you know, the staff from the country. We have no expat staff. And so people, you know, with familiarity with the context and a context in which we do, you know, we do talk and work with communities and check that the right children are being supported. But we find that transparency and trust is actually almost the self-policing, if you like, because there's a real pride in the community and a real desire to maintain the integrity of the of the work itself. And I can't remember the third part of your question. What was it?
That was it.
I think you
covered it.
Did I cover it? You know, I'd just tell you an anecdote from a man called Mr. Palani, who's the commissioner. That means he's responsible for all development in his district, for the Neno district. And he was doing an interview with Angeline, whom I mentioned, who's the executive director for Zimbabwe. And he said, you know, many organizations, they come to us at the beginning just so that they can tick their local, you know, local community participation box. So they invite me to an event. And he said, the next time they call me is when the donor comes to town and they want me to sit there and say the right things. And he said, for the rest of the time, we're treated like crooks or people to be avoided. And you know, that is, he was saying, we're different. And, you know, but that is quite common, that there is this system whereby you work, you know, in parallel. And the actual pre-existing system is as if it doesn't exist at all. And people are deeply offended, of course, by that. So I think for us, in terms of that selection, the integrity of the selection process, it actually depends on the trust and the relationship that we build.
Yeah. So since its inception in 1993, has there been other organisations who have tried to sort of mimic what you're doing? And if so, have they been successful?
Well, we certainly are working in a highly collaborative way with many organisations. As I mentioned, I just come back from Canada, where I was working with the University of Ottawa and CEDA and other organisations like Plan Save the Children, who are actually expanding their work in girls' education. And we would see mimicry as something, you know, we would really hope to see. I think that it's a bit, you know, when you've got a very big agency, it's a bit like turning a line around, and it takes time to change. And I think at the moment, CAMFED we'll be £20 million budget of £20 million income. And I think, you know, our size is such that we're very adaptable at the moment. And some organisations, they almost envy our adaptability. What we must do is maintain that adaptability as we grow. But certainly agencies like DFID, the Department for International Development, USAID in the US, CEDA itself, are really promoting our model to the agencies that they fund and increasingly inviting us to actually, you know, share the model. Because many agencies, of course, have a great breadth in what they do. Ours has been more specialist. So, you know, the mimicry is growing, and I think that's a measure of our success.
Thank you very much. We're going to run out of time, or we have really run out of time. I've got an eye on Rebecca, who is keeping me moving. Do you want us to come off and you go up, or are you going to join us?
I'm going to join you.
Okay.
Firstly, I'm going to thank you, Kate, for an interesting introduction and for chairing so ably. So thank you. And of course, thank you, Anne, for a fantastic lecture this evening, which was very thought-provoking. And as a small token of our gratitude, I have a gift for you, which is a guide of the hall and the gardens to remind you of Madingley. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you all.
Thank you.
while I'm saying thank yous, I'd also like to thank colleagues who have helped with the arrangements for this evening. And also I'd like to say that I hope that I will see many of you back here in future at the Institute of Continuing Education, perhaps not only for future Mattingly lectures or Mattingly concerts, but also studying with us. You should have brochures on your seats. Please do take them away and study them with care and pass them on to your friends and family. The next Mattingly lecture is on the 20th of June, when we have Professor William Brown, who's the Montague Burton Professor of Industrial Relations, who will be speaking on how might we protect the wages of the weak. And you'd be very welcome to join us back here at Mattingly Hall then on the 20th of June. So thank you very much for coming. And the exit is via the door at the back of the room, unless you have an invite to just stay with us a little while longer, in which case we'll be leaving by the door at the back in a few moments. So thank you and good evening.